My name is Susie. I have three children, the youngest of whom struggles with anxiety, depression, and suicidal ideation. I never thought this could happen to me, and I miss the signs. Being a parent is really hard, but I'm here to help. I'm talking to other parents and experts to help you with the struggles that your kids may face. I want you to know that you are not alone and there is hope. I'm not a physician, therapist, or counselor. I'm just a mom.
I want to see you smile again, take away that pain in them clouds that keep covering up the sun.
This episode of the Just a Mom podcast is the second in a two-part series with Ryan Lefevre, play-by-play announcer for the Kansas City Royals. If you haven't listened to the previous episode, please go back and listen to it before you start this one. Thanks again for listening to the Just a Mom podcast. Now here's the rest of my conversation with Ryan.
I can't tell you when you're going to get better. I can't tell you what your life is going to be like after you get better. But will you allow me to do something with this? And it gave me some peace. And I went back to sleep. And I'd like to tell you that I woke up the next day and I felt better. I did. And I felt awful the next day. We played the final game of the season in Toronto. We flew home to Kansas City. And this kind of goes back to an earlier conversation we had. That's when I had the big blow up on the phone with my friend. And something happened to me that night because I went to bed and I woke up the next day. The season was over and I felt better. So so the medication took a month and 2 days. It's not the same for everybody. It kicks in at different times, but I really did start to feel better. My counseling sessions were more productive because before I was on the medication, I would have these great revelations and I would call my mom on the drive home. But by the time I went to bed at night, I felt terrible again. I woke up the next morning. I felt terrible. All of a sudden now these counseling sessions, it's like everything I was learning about myself. It was like, it was sticking to me longer. It wasn't like when we were kids and we'd make those, wad up those paper towels and you throw them against the wall and they stick and then they fall off. Well, now it was sticking and it was like these feelings of hope were staying with me for 2 or 3 days and then a week and then 2 weeks. So the medication really did level me out, but I never forgot what Eric told me. And so I was on the Xanax probably about 3 or 4 weeks until I felt like I didn't need it anymore. And I was on the Lexapro for about 3.5 years. And I did a very slow weaning off. I was scared to death of the side effects if I weaned off. I think I took about 3 months or 4 months to slowly wean off of it. I haven't gone on any kind of medication like that since, but I would. But it was a very important point in my triangle of recovery because the counseling and the life coaching went to a completely different depth when I was able to get my thoughts and my brain balanced in a way where I could think more rationally.
Exactly. And I like what you said about, you know, for you, it was not something that you needed to take for the rest of your life, but for some people it is. And that's for a person and his or her treatment team mm-hmm. to work yep. with together to figure out that balance. So I appreciate you bringing that up. And particularly, again, I mean, this was almost 20 years ago that men were not talking about this. And I would dare say that men, a lot of men are still not talking about it. I just read an article the other day that youth suicide numbers have in 2022 actually went down, but men between the ages of, I believe it was 55 and 65, their numbers have gone up in the numbers of suicide. And I just want to encourage people men in particular, and we have male listeners, but it's okay to not be okay. And Ryan is such a great example of, hey, you know what? I don't feel good. I'm going to call my mom, you know, whoever it is that you call, I'm going to call somebody, and that person hopefully will help encourage you to get the help that you need, which is exactly what your mom did. And then you had all these friends right. speaking into your life as well along the way, which is such a huge blessing. And yes, you hadn't really told them about your struggles initially, but as time went on and you did, you had a whole team of friends on your side.
Yeah. And it all began with me talking about it. And I mean, nobody could help me until I started talking about it. And, you know, I'd like to add something to what you said. Yeah. And this, I think this will relate to your male audience. Yes, it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay. Let's see if I can articulate this. It's not okay to accept that for the rest of your life. We have gone from it's not okay to not be okay to it's okay to not be okay to now we need to figure out a way to not shame people for feeling the way that they feel, but start working on personal accountability now that, yes, this might be something that is rooted in your childhood or something that happened 20 years ago, but it's not okay to continue to blame that person and take yourself off the hook for your bad decisions. It's time to go to work. It's time to take the person or the circumstance that hurt you off the hook and put you on the hook. And, that was something, and maybe it was the athlete in me that like, it was a challenge. I was going to work towards something. There's a very manly quote by Winston Churchill that in the last year has taken on a new meaning for me. And I use it a lot when I speak, and I see you nodding because I think I used it at the speaking engagement that we attended. But Winston Churchill said years ago, if you find yourself going through hell, keep going. Now, that's a very manly thing to say, you know, put your head down and just, you know, just press forward. But I began to realize that there's a lot more to that statement because we have three choices when we find ourselves going through hell or whatever we want to describe as hell on earth. We realize we're going through hell. And it scares us and we run out of there and we basically run back out the way that we came in and we don't really deal with it. The second kind is we find ourselves going through hell and we lose hope and we think that that's just where we were meant to be and that's where we're going to remain for the rest of our lives. And we create this comfort zone. And I feel like now, the next step for a lot of people is to not make this home and not find people that we can commiserate with. We have all been victimized in some way that we didn't choose, but we do get to choose whether we're going to label ourselves a victim or not. That's our choice. And so, but some people out of fear or lack of hope or whatever, have now decided to make sitting in hell a comfort zone and a good thing. And it's inevitable. There's nothing we can do about it. So let's just make the most of it right here. And then if I did anything right, Susie, I found myself going through hell and I just kept going. And I didn't know how long it was going to be. I didn't know if I was going to go left or I was going to go right when I came to turns in the road, but I just had determined and decided that I was just going to keep going. And I don't know how long I would have lasted if I didn't get the results when I did, but I decided that if I wasn't going to make it, it wasn't going to be because I didn't try. And so, yes, it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to not do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad that you brought that up because that was on my list, was your Winston Churchill quote. I actually wrote all that down when you spoke because it really, really struck me in a very powerful way. And you're right. We have to, it's not okay to not get the help that we need and to sit in it. Mm-hmm. that's really good. You talk a lot, and you have referenced this already. You talk a lot about your Christian faith and how that has been such an important part of your journey. You're even in the depths of your depression, you're calling out to God, you're praying. I am also a Christian. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that the church in general, our Christian heritage and faith has not always been necessarily embracing to mental illness or mental health issues. And a lot of times, I don't know if you experienced this, but even just a few years ago when my son was struggling, I had people, very well-intentioned people, but people say some of the most hurtful and wrong things to me about, you know, well, can't you just pray harder? Can't you just, you know, make this go away because you believe in God, you're a Christian. And I think that that is still a somewhat prevalent thought amongst Christians. Would you just talk a little bit about what your experience has been there?
Yeah. Cause I went through some of that. But then I'm using a lot of metaphors and examples here, and I hope I'm not boring you to death with them, but I think everyone's heard about the guy whose house is being flooded, and he's in his house and the water's up to his ankles and he's praying to God, please save me, God, from this flood. And then it's up, you know, and it's up to his waist, and you know, his neighbor drives by in a four-wheeler and says, jump in, come on, we need to get out of here. And he says, no, God's going to save me. God's going to save me. And then it's, you know, it's up to his waist or his chest. And now a boat comes by his house and says, come on, your house is going to get flooded. You're going to die. Get in the boat. No. God's going to save me. God's going to save me. And then he finally crawls up on his roof and a helicopter flies over and puts a ladder down and says, come on, jump on the ladder. We got to go. The flood's going to cover your house. Nope. I'm praying. God's going to help me. God's going to help me. And he dies in the flood. And he goes to heaven and he says to God, I prayed. Why didn't you save me? And he says, I sent you a truck. I sent you a boat and I sent you a helicopter. So what is that balance for a person of faith? And I think most people who said what they said to you and probably said to me what they said to me had never been through what we had been through before. Who's to say God didn't inspire the person who came up with the medication that saved me? My counselor, Dale Williamson, was a Christian. My life coach, Gary Kuzmic, was a Christian. For us to put ourselves in the place of God, for us to become judge and decide how God is going to work in other people's lives is completely against the scripture that we use to decide whether we're Christians or not. And so the world today so badly wants to put God or put Jesus in a box in a way that works for them. And when I humbled myself and realized I'm not God, I'm not Jesus, and I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm going to allow myself to be used in some way. I'm going to surrender my outcome, and I'm going to allow him to work through me. My depression, Susie, was the answer to a prayer. A close friend of mine, Mike Sweeney, strong Christian man, huge influence on me. He was speaking, and I don't even remember where it was, but I'll never forget what he said. And this was prior to my depression, but I was still having some feelings like, you know, and there are several references in the Bible about us being purified, us being refined. As a silversmith refined silver, as a goldsmith purifies gold, whatever. And if you know how that was done, and still is today, the jeweler will take the raw metal and burn from the bottom the impurities to the surface. And as the impurities come to the surface, the jeweler, with a very keen eye, begins to wipe those impurities away. And as the process continues, fewer and fewer impurities come up, and you keep wiping away. And when the jeweler sees nothing but his own reflection in the stone, he takes the flame away. And so I was so inspired. I went home that night and I just prayed that God would purify me. And I woke up the next day and I thought it must have happened in my sleep, because I woke up the next morning and I felt great. And I felt purified and I prayed to be purified. But God answered my prayer. And here comes the flame. And the flame was my depression, and it hurt. But a lot of impurities came to the surface. And because of my faith in Jesus, I believe along the way, I hope that he was wiping away those impurities. If I was willing, this gets back to my counseling and my life coach and my sharing my life. If I was willing to allow those impurities to come out, if I was willing to allow those impurities to be exposed for other people to see, and to for me to recognize the impurities, that he then would wipe them out. And whether he saw my reflection or whether he saw his reflection in me or not, I can't sit here and tell you that he did, but I know that he pulled the flame away. Because the other part of that story, Susie, is if the silversmith or the goldsmith holds the flame there too long, then you will take the process too far and you will damage the gold or the silver. I was not damaged because of it. And so when I was able to surrender what I thought was going to be a life of things and accomplishments that was going to make me happy, a life with the prettiest girl in the class on my arm because that would impress everybody else, and that my life became one of just dealing with the heart that he gave me, the personality that he gave me, the person that he designed me to be, my life coach, the first thing my life coach Gary said to me is, he goes, "Is Ryan enough?" And what his thinking was is, let's say I wasn't a broadcaster for the Royals. Let's say I didn't live in a house on a lake. Let's say I didn't have two nice cars in the garage and a boat and a jet ski down at the dock. Would I still have friends? Would people still like me? Would I still be able to find a wife and have a family someday? Or did I believe that I needed all of those things? I didn't believe Ryan was enough. I really didn't. But for a person of faith, I realized that Ryan was enough. But the last step is I had to realize that Jesus was enough. Because even is Ryan enough is kind of a self-centered thing. It's all about Ryan. And that's the version of my story that I tell when I know that I have an audience of people of faith. And it's a hard thing, as you know, as a Christian, it's a hard thing to explain to other people, because there are a lot of hurting Christians in the world that want to play God and they want to judge other people. And I've learned that those people like me who want to judge other people with their faith, and they use their faith as a weapon, they're probably hiding something that's going on in their life. And it's a lot more convenient to get somebody else before they get them. And so I found myself a lot less judgmental. I found myself a lot more compassionate, and just understanding that I was created in God's image. God was not created in my image. And so years after I had recovered from my depression, there was still some healing to do. And it was to dive deeper into my faith, and the faith that God created, not the one that I created.
That's really good. I want to read a quote from your book that you said about God. "God is more interested in making your life holy than he is in making your life happy. And no matter how hard things are in your life, there is always something you can thank God for. I think that's such a powerful line.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing to be released of impurities. But many of us go through seasons like I went through and then just take on those impurities again. And I needed to understand the concept of what it meant to be holy, to be set apart, to rely on Him. And I'll say this, and just to be fair, I'll just say this to people of faith, people who are deep into their faith, people who are questioning their faith, people who are exploring faith. There's a reason why if you go to a bookstore, and sadly there aren't as many bookstores as there used to be, but there's a reason if you, and I studied self-help books and I learned some really practical exercises to improve my life in self-help books. People who have studied this, they're experts in it, and they sell a lot of books because they're really good at it. But for someone who studied this for years, it finally hit me one day that the self-help book sections at the bookstore just kept getting bigger and bigger, and more books came out every year. And every book has some knowledge and some wisdom in it. But the Bible section didn't get any bigger. And I realized there's a lot in that one book. Everything you need is in that one book. And I think a lot of self-help books pick out little things from the Bible that work for them in their lifestyle. Oh, I like this. That works. I like this. Ooh, I don't like that. Okay, we're not going to write about that. And that's a lot about the way I lived my life. So I had to figure out the ones that I didn't like. And maybe I never really figured out the ones that I didn't like. But I knew it was God's will in my life for me to do my very best to apply those things and understand that they're just guardrails for me in this life of turns and hills and slippery roads and not knowing what's coming around the corner, that it's not designed to take joy away from me, but it's designed to protect me. And so that's where I gain the majority of my inspiration now is every year. I say every year. This is my second year. I read through the Bible, and the amount of knowledge that I get every single day sustains me for that day.
Well, and good for you for being on your second year of doing that, because that is a monumental task. But I really applaud that you are doing that, and I have no doubt that every day you learn something new, even though you've already read it, because that's what the Bible does.
It's a living, breathing book.
Yep.
It's a living, breathing book. And there's so many things that I've read before, but how did I miss this? Mm-hmm. That's the part that I love about it.
Mm-hmm. Let's transition a little bit. And I want to talk about another thing that you spend time on in your book discussing, that again, a lot of, and not to overgeneralize, but a lot of men don't talk about, but it's intimacy and how you learned the importance of intimacy in your relationships. Would you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah. So the title of the book is the Shame of Me. And that was not my idea. That was my co-author, Jeffrey Flanagan's idea. But I did write a chapter in the book called The Shame of Man. That was my idea, because I began to question that myself. Like, why suddenly now am I so willing to talk about this stuff? Mm. There's a lot more on the line for me now. I mean, I've got a job that, a lot of people are aware of my job. A lot of people know me because of my job. So why now? I mean, there's a, I'm really putting myself out there. And I wasn't afraid of putting myself out there, but why wasn't I afraid of putting myself out there? And why did I used to be afraid to put myself out there? Like, what's going on right now? And as I began to dig deeper, I realized that there's this shame that men deal with. And there's this expectation that we have in our culture, you know, the culture of masculinity, and although it's becoming less and less masculine, but that we're supposed to be tough. And the way it was explained to me, mm-hmm. Susie, was that I had to separate tough and brave. So if you think about things that are tough, a helmet, a parka when it's really cold outside, leather gloves, an eggshell, things that are tough on the outside because there's something very delicate on the inside. And so I started to see that my pursuit of toughness was really me guarding against people seeing what was really going on the inside. So people that are keep people at a distance, or they have this tough outer shell, if you will, their personality is, you know, they don't let things get to them or whatever, men and women, you know, I just don't let that bother me. You know, how can you not let that bother you? It's a defense mechanism. I need to keep you here because I can't afford for you to know what's going on right here. And then it was, are you willing to be brave enough? Because that's a masculine word. I mean, that's a word of strength. Are you willing to be brave enough to allow people to see what's going on inside mm-hmm. of you? Intimacy, to be known, intimacy, into me see. And I really, what did it for me was other people being emotionally intimate with me, other men, when I began to talk about what I was going through, saying, I went through the same thing. Do you remember feeling like this? Yes, I do. Do you remember ever feeling like this? Yes, I do. In fact, I even used to think this. You did? I mean, so it was modeled for me. And probably the most powerful thing that helped me in my recovery was other people sharing their stories with me, because I could look at them and say, you? Really? Because you look like you have it together so much now. Well, that's because of what I went through. Now all of a sudden my role in all this completely changes. Now it's like, now there's the whisper from God. This is what I was talking about. And when I went public with it, it was in spring training of 2006. It was the very next year. And I wasn't done with my healing and my counseling, but I had come a long way. I was on the other side of it. And I was seeing the world through different colored lenses. And I was interviewed in the Kansas City Star by Jeff Passan, who's a very well-known national baseball writer and television personality. At the time, he was a writer at the Kansas City Star. And the Star back then used to do a huge spread in the sports page on opening day for baseball. And there was a theme. There was a theme every year. And they would have all these great articles that just tied into this one theme. And I think the theme was something like, do you know? And it was like, do you know this person? Do you know that person? Do you really know this person? Something like that. And I guess it was my turn to be interviewed. And so I was at a restaurant in Arizona with Jeff Pass, and he said, we want to do a story on, do you know, the Royals? At that time, I was mostly doing radio. Do you know Ryan LaFever, the Royals radio announcer? This would have been year number 7 for me. And so year 8 for me. And so people knew my name, but I don't know if they really knew a whole lot about me. But we're at dinner. We go through some small talk. He gets out his recorder back when we had recorders, and he puts it on the table and he hits record and he says, I'll never forget it. He says, okay, so who is Ryan LaFever? And I had two choices. I could give the same interview I'd given 100 times before, where I'm from, my baseball career, growing up with my dad, becoming a young broadcaster, which broadcasters influenced me, what my favorite game to broadcast was, what my favorite call was. I've given that interview who knows how many times, but I felt like I was hearing the whisper from God and saying, here you go. Here's your chance. And I told him everything about my depression, which he wasn't expecting. But I realized through my experience that being intimate, emotionally intimate, was not just about me. I realized that if I opened the barn doors of my heart, that might help another man open his barn doors, which helps someone else, that there was like this butterfly effect, that here was that night in Toronto, the night in Toronto, when I was questioning whether I wanted to go through this anymore, will you allow me to do something with this? And so, but when I could see that, maybe I wasn't going to be tough anymore, but that I could be brave, and that was still a very honorable word. That basically fueled my willingness to be intimate. I also write in the book that I also realized there were different types of intimacy. Men are really good at physical intimacy. A lot of men struggle with pornography and have other sexual issues inside and outside of marriages because it's all of their intimacy is tied into physical intimacy. Well, there's also intellectual intimacy. I realize that if I have this crazy idea about broadcasting or, you know, Susie's got this crazy idea about a podcast called Just a Mom Podcast. And, you obviously shared that with somebody and somebody said, that's a great idea. And here's my thought. And then here you are. So there's a part of us intellectually that we need to share. But that can go too far. There's some people, we all have friends and all they talk about is what they're doing at work and this and that and blah, blah, blah. It's just like, oh my gosh, after a while, because all of their intimacy is tied into their intellect. Then there is emotional intimacy, which is very hard for men. Women are much more wired to connect emotionally. You know, men say, how you doing? Fine. How are you? Fine. Women get together. How you doing? Well, I'm going to tell you how I'm doing. And so from that respect, women do not have an issue with emotional intimacy that the degree that men have. And then there's spiritual intimacy. You know, I mean, what is it that's going on around us that we're just not seeing right now? Or do you feel like there's something else going on? Do you feel like, yeah, this is happening, but do you feel like there's something else going on around it? Well, what is it? What do you think? What's a scripture that ties into this? And then I arrived upon, one day I was in my house and I was looking out at my sprinklers and one of my sprinkler heads was out and, it was clogged. And so there was a part of my lawn that was not getting watered, but then I realized another one of the sprinklers then was taking on the load of the sprinkler that was clogged. And all of a sudden, like, I just realized like the intimacy was, oh, here's what happens if we shut off our emotional intimacy. There's going to be more funneled towards our physical intimacy. If we shut off our physical intimacy, then it's going to be funneled somewhere else. If we shut off two of them, then those other two, you know, there's just going to be an overload. And it just came to me as I was looking out on my lawn that for me to be balanced, not only did I have to have a heart of intimacy, but I had to have all four of those intimacies. I had to be able to express myself physically. I had to be able to express myself intellectually. I had to be able to express myself emotionally, and I had to be able to express myself spiritually.
And I do think as a woman, I think more women than we would admit struggle with emotional intimacy as well. And I think that's part of why, and I can't speak for other women, but I can speak for myself is, you know, it took me a long time to get to the point where I could talk about my story as a parent with a child who struggles with mental illness. Well, why, right? What was that about me that didn't want to share that? Well, you know, again, not wanting to be vulnerable, emotionally intimate with very many people about what I was going through. So I think it's a far more common issue for women than we will often admit. So thank you for delineating those four areas too. I think that that's a really, really valuable piece of information for anybody to take and learn and make part of what they are working on continuously in their lives. So thank you for that.
It's a quick checklist, Susie. When you see somebody, do you shake their hand and do you look them in the eye? Do you give someone a hug if it's appropriate? I mean, when you give them a hug, do you really give them a hug? You know, do you share with people what interests you? You know, do you share with people what you're afraid of? And do you share with people, you know, is something else going on that I may not be able to see, that I have a purpose in life that I might be aware of? It's just a checklist. What's missing? What's missing out of those four? And then ask yourself, you know, where am I overloading? Like, why do I have this? Why can't I shut this one off? Well, it's because probably you've turned another one. Another one's turned off and everything is flowing through this one. And by the way, when I say, let me backtrack here, because I don't want to offend anybody, but I think there's a very stereotypical disconnect a lot of times with a husband and wife when it comes to intimacy. You know, the man's intimacy is, let's just go to bed and have some physical intimacy with each other and I'm going to feel a lot better. And generally speaking, sometimes a woman is just like, well, hang on, I have some things that I want to talk to you about first. And so, as I was realizing my issues, I wasn't stereotyping people, but I began to admire, female friends that I had that were so willing to talk to me and listen to me when I would say things that I felt were really irrational, that they had radars and they had ears to accept these things, more naturally than some of my guy friends who are like, what are you talking about? Let's just go do whatever and we're going to feel better. So,
Ryan, is there anything that we haven't talked about or that I haven't asked you that you want to make sure the listeners know about who Ryan is, about your story, or about mental health in general?
Well, I'll address mental health in general. You asked me a question about if we're a person of faith and someone very well-meaning might say,
that's a good point.
Well, you should just be praying harder, or maybe your faith isn't very strong right now. And that's why you're experiencing depression. Well, nobody says that to a Christian who's a diabetic. Nobody ever says, you know what? You're right. Maybe you should stop taking your insulin. Have you thought about doing that? Or, you know what? You're right. Maybe you should stop taking your pain medication after just having knee replacement. I love that that we're talking about mental health, because one of the worst things that ever happened to me in the summer of 05 was also one of the best things. And I had the equivalent of a nervous breakdown, a panic attack, whatever you want to call it, at a restaurant in New York City after a Royals game against the Yankees. And I went to bed that night and I was sweating. My heart was pounding. I couldn't sleep. And I began to realize, you know what? Maybe there's something medically wrong with me. Maybe this isn't just about my will as a man. Maybe it has nothing to do with my strength as a man. Maybe there's something like that's beyond my control here. And so when we talk about mental health, I think the focus has been such where this is being seen more now as a medical condition. And there are more and more people trained now to help you with your medical condition. And that was a turning point for me. My counseling, great. Life coach, great. But the time that when the medication really started to work for me, and I began to realize that I was fighting against a medical condition, and not that I'd become this soft male who you know, just felt sorry for himself because life didn't turn out the way that he had wanted to, but I had a medical condition. And depression, of all the other definitions, the one that Dale Williamson, my counselor taught me was, is that if how we feel is congruent with our life circumstance, then we are just feeling depressed. But if you were like me and your life circumstance is incongruent with how you feel about yourself, life, generally speaking, is pretty good, but you don't feel right, then you may possibly are depressed. And you're not weak. There's something going on that somebody can help you with. But if you treat it like a medical condition, and you take your will and your strength and whatever you want to call it, and just put it aside for a while and go to talk to somebody about it, talk to a medical professional about it. And this is not a reflection of your character. It's just something you're going through right now. That was really the beginning of the healing for me.
That's good. I really appreciate you sharing that. That was another one of the quotes that I had highlighted. My book here, the copy that I got at that event, The Shame of Me, One Man's Journey to Depression and Back. I would highly encourage our listeners to get a copy of it. I'll make sure it's in the show notes because it's a very powerful book. And if a person hasn't read it, I think everybody should read it because you are so open and honest and vulnerable with what you went through and then also your healing journey and how you went through that healing journey and came out on the other side of it. And I really appreciate your sharing today with me and with our listeners. And I appreciate that you're fighting a cold and your voice and you have a speaking engagement tonight and you still were willing to do this for our audience and to help people. And I want to point out again, and you've said it, but I really appreciate also that you use the platform that you have to help share this message of there's hope, you're not alone, and get help. And I really appreciate that you do that. So Ryan Lefevre, thank you again for being a guest on this episode of the Just a Mom podcast.
Well, thank you, Susie. And again, I appreciate your patience with trying to be a father again after the baseball season with four kids and trying to make this time of the year easier for my wife so she can go do some of the things she can't do during the baseball season. So we've been trying to connect for a couple of months, and I appreciate your patience. It was great talking with you, and thank you for everything you're doing. You are more than just a mom.
Oh, thank you, Ryan. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts or ideation, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 988.
I want to see you smile again, take away that pain in them clouds that keep covering up the sun.
If you found this podcast helpful, please subscribe and leave a rating and or a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, please share this with your friends and anyone you think may find these interviews helpful. Thanks again for listening to Just a Mom.